From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's start the week with a scenario. It's New Year's Eve in Times Square and a million people are on the street. Do you want the partiers to be carrying firearms? Congress is considering a new law called Concealed Carry Reciprocity, and here's how it works. A state with tighter gun restrictions would have to honor the laws from states with looser restrictions. So if someone from, say, Oklahoma goes to Times Square on New Year's Eve, police could not confiscate his firearm.
So we welcomed Gary Putup from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence and Paul Simonelli, a local attorney who supports this new law. Here's Simonelli talking about why, yeah, he wants people on Times Square to have guns. He wants more Americans to carry guns.
We've seen the targets, people have become targets where people aren't allowed to have any sort of firearms. And, you know, this is a discussion for another day, but the reality is bad people go after soft targets. They don't go after hard targets.
I don't think it's a discussion for another day, and here's why. I understand the point that you're making there, but you're also sort of implying that on New Year's Eve, if someone starts shooting, you want concealed carry people in the crowd. I don't want anybody in the crowd of a million people just with a gun to pull out and start looking for a target and start firing. Isn't that going to be more chaos? And on top of that, the counterpoint I often hear is this. When there are guns present and when there is alcohol present and other substances present and things escalate and people are in close quarters, a million people on New Year's Eve, I know that people who concealed carry almost always respect the law, understand the law, are well trained. But you want them carrying a gun in a huge crowd when things kind of go south in when someone's been drinking? That's another part of the argument. Do you disagree?
I'm not opposed to that if they're acting responsibly. I really have no problem at all. If I choose to carry my gun, I know what the laws are in New York relating to alcohol. I also know what my tolerance is for alcohol. And if I choose to carry a gun, I will act accordingly. We had this incident 2 years ago here in Rochester on Christmas Eve. Possible terrorist attack. And I typically don't go out for New Year's Eve, but I had plans to go out in the city of Rochester that night. And I did go out, and I was responsible in my actions and how I comported myself that evening because I wanted to make sure that the people that were around me that I cared about were protected.
And we keep bringing up well-trained. There's no training at all to get a pistol permit.
I think the NRA's wider point is gun owners are respectful people. They're responsible. They, whether they're required to or not, tend to be well-trained.
That's the part I'm going to challenge. I don't know what the NRA is saying, but the fact of the matter, there is no training at all required for this. And this is one of the problems with concealed carry. In fact, even in Monroe County, the training consists of nothing. You can go to Monroe County, you can get a pistol permit, never receive any training. You don't even need to own a gun. You can go buy a gun a year later, never shoot the thing, never get any training and carry it. And this is the same way, like in Vermont. Again, let's do our neighbor state, Vermont. There's no training required. This whole idea that they're well-trained. I mean, we can say all these other things, but I think it's important for the audience and for people to know, the public to know. The NRA can say these people are well-trained. There is no training. There's no training requirement at all.
Next, billionaire philanthropist Tom Golisano is fired up about the New York State assessment system. He says property owners get gouged all the time with bad assessments. One example is his own property, a large lakefront home on Canandaigua Lake. Golisano is so convinced that he's been treated unfairly that he's still withholding a $90,000 payment to the Naples School District.
Now, Golisano is launching a statewide campaign aimed at changing the assessment system. You can expect to see billboards and TV ads and maybe even a class action lawsuit on behalf of property owners. Here's Golisano explaining why he's doing this.
Our real estate taxes compared to the rest of the country are just ridiculously high. But the other part of the problem is, how do they determine our real estate taxes? And they use a process called the assessment. The assessment is where an employee of the town or the village or the county goes around and puts a market value, a theoretical market value, on a home. And then the taxes are based on the assessment or market value of the home. Now, you have one person doing this. The range of certification and training for having this job varies greatly from community to community. How a person can make an efficient, effective assessment of a value of a property without even going inside the property, because 99% of the time they do not. So what's happened because of this unique process? Well, the fact of the matter is, I took it upon myself to do some research and find out what is really happening when you compare market value versus the assessment, or the sale price versus the assessment. Now, comparing the sales price, I mean, that's fact. The assessment is fact. So let's say that if we looked at a group of homes and we looked at how many homes were sold at less than the assessment, or more than the assessment. Now, obviously, if they're sold for less than the assessment, people say, gee, did I overpay? Well, let me give you some information. In Albany and Rensselaer County, 39% of the homes were overassessed. 39%. These are actual sales now. These aren't speculations. Broome County, 51%. Erie County, 22%. Monroe County, 29% of the homes sold, the assessment was higher than the sale value. Now, that tells you people have had to pay, not just 1 year, but over a period of years, a higher level of taxes because it's based on an assessed price versus a real price, and that is the sale price. Now, I understand you have sometimes extenuating circumstances in a sale. For example, a father selling a home to a daughter or a son or sister to a brother or something like that, or a real distress situations, which those things happen. But generally speaking, the variances between sales price and assessment are huge. Now, I'm going to give you one more. Let's assume for a moment, okay, assessor, we'll allow you a 10% variance. In other words, if you look at a house at $200,000 and you assess it at $180,000 or all the way up to $220,000, that's 10% off that $200,000. That sounds, you know, it could be somewhat fair, but 10% is still a lot. Well, listen to this. In Monroe County, 48% of the homes were underassessed by more than 10%. Now you could say, well, those people should be paying more taxes, shouldn't they? If the thing is to be fair. And 16% of the homes that were transferred in June in Monroe County were higher than a 10% variance off the assessment. So obviously those people are having to pay significantly more. So what do we want to have happen? Well, the first thing, I think these people that have sold their homes for under the assessment, they have a justification in suing the county and state governments.
Is the idea of a class action lawsuit a good form of saber rattling to get them to actually do something, or do you think you're actually going to go forward with a lawsuit?
Well, at the rate people are signing up for it, I think there's a lot of people out there that actually want us to do it. And quite frankly, if we don't get a good positive reaction from our governments, I think we should go forward with it.
Next, a conversation about mental health in the African American community and the exertion it takes to go through life as a person of color. In other words, the psychic cost of being Black. According to the Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health, African Americans are 20% more likely to experience serious mental health problems than the general population. And they say that's because of racism, socioeconomic factors, and higher levels of homelessness and exposure to violence.
The strategy for coping with those stressors is known as John Henryism. The term comes from American folklore and the story of a steel driver named John Henry who raced a steam-powered machine. He won that race, but died as a result of the exertion. Now the term John Henryism is used to describe the coping mechanism used by African Americans when dealing with prolonged psychological stress caused by racism and discrimination.
In this clip, you'll hear Melanie Funches. She's the Director of Community Engagement at the Mental Health Association of Rochester. Here she is discussing how John Henryism manifests itself in daily life.
This is very real. There are a number of studies that have been done, and there's been meta-analysis of all of these things that say that there is a physical cost to the repeated experience of oppression experienced by African-American people. And one of the things they talk about, there's a documentary called Uncommon Causes, are inequality making us sick? And in part of that, they talk about how when you look at African-American women and you look at birth rates, and they looked at educated African-American, like college-educated African-American women of middle-class status have some of the same birth outcome rates as teenage white, young white women, white girls without a high school diploma. And if you control for everything else, it's about the physical toll on our bodies of experiencing racism, you know, and oppression on the daily basis. It's like the air. And, you know, people say, well, Melanie, what do you mean by that? I'm like, it's like the air. If you are seeing a police car pull up behind you and your heart rate automatically accelerates, you're having, you know, all these things, your breathing accelerates just because you see it. It doesn't have to stop. You don't have to have done anything wrong. But if you're having these experiences because of what you know that can happen, that wears on you. And that's just what that is.
And so I think before the program began, you mentioned sort of a difference in effective age among races.
Yes, there is a study that talks about telomeres, which are these little ends on our DNA. And they basically chronicle your organ age. And when you take black women and if you look at the telomeres, black women internally are 7.5 years older than their white counterparts. And we were looking at the study and we looked at this because there's a saying talk about black doesn't crack, that black women age magnificently. We look fabulous into old age, right? And so that being said, but internally we age faster. So if me and my girlfriend are, you know, young professionals, we're getting married, we're having babies, and we're both 30 chronologically, her body is 30. She's white. Her body is 30. I'm 37 and a half. We know what happens for women giving birth later, the potential for birth defects and trouble and hard pregnancies. So if we know this, you know, we know that this is going on, there's consequences to that. And it's just, that's just, and when you regulate for everything else, it's come out in the literature that it's because of racism and oppression.
Let's close the week with some music. Kate Lee O'Connor is a Webster native and a Grammy Award winning artist. She is a lead singer and a fiddler with the O'Connor Family Band, and they really are a family. Her husband is Forrest O'Connor, who plays mandolin, and her father-in-law is fiddler Mark O'Connor.
Kate and Forrest were in Rochester for a performance at the Eastman School of Music, and they stopped by WXXI to talk to us about what it means to make it in the music industry. We'll hear their thoughts, and then we'll listen to their performance of the song Ruby at last year's Grammy Awards.
I'm still working really hard to get to a certain level, and I still feel like I haven't made it yet, per se. You know, who knows what that means? But it's like, maybe if I had gotten really well-known or, I don't know, famous or something at a young age, that would have really messed with my head or something. But for the most part, it was really good, positive attention, but it wasn't overwhelming. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't too much too soon.
No, mm-hmm. I don't think so. A lot of it was through school and playing with friends of mine who played music as well. So I got a lot of time to hang out with kids my own age too. And a lot of times music kind of facilitated that.
But what does making it really mean then, if you don't still consider yourself as having made it?
Yeah, I don't know what it means. I think, you know, we've even talked to Forrest's dad, Mark, who's now my father-in-law, and I guess you don't ever feel like I don't know, maybe if you get to be such a huge superstar, you can't deny it.
Like literally, if you walk down the street and everyone knows your name.
Yeah, maybe at that point mm-hmm. you can't deny it. But otherwise, I think you're just always trying to get your music out there more and get better. I still feel like I'm becoming a better singer and musician.
Sure. Well, we'll let our listeners decide if they think that Kate and Forrest have made it. Let's listen to a little bit of Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man from the Grammys. And I want to say that before you listen to this clip, the first comment, you never want to read the comment section at YouTube. This is toxic, right? This is the first comment of many on the YouTube site where this song is from. I'm going to quote it. That's not dynamite. That's nitroglycerin in a pressure cooker with Blow Mind bluegrass. Love that.
That's awesome.
It's like the nicest thing on YouTube that's ever been written.
Yeah.
So let's listen to it.
Ruby, Ruby, honey, are you mad at your man? Ruby,
So who's Ruby? Who wrote that song?
Cousin Emmy wrote that song, and she was, I think her real name was Mae Carver, and she was a vaudeville act in the early 1900s. And then it became a bluegrass standard when the Osborne Brothers covered it, I think in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's been covered by a lot of artists. But we're probably one of the more unique covers because it's a female singing it. Although I know Rhiannon Giddens also does a really cool version of Ruby.
What was that like performing that night? Set the scene for us a little.
It was nerve-wracking for sure. You know, it's funny because we were nominated for the Grammy for Best Bluegrass Album, but I wasn't even really thinking about whether we were going to win that or not, because all I was really thinking about was doing the performance, which was before they announced our category. So it was a little bit nerve-wracking, but they gave us a really great rehearsal time the day before, and we got to run through it a bunch of times with their production crew, and it was over before we knew it. I mean, it's such a fast song, made faster by nerves. And
there's no click tracks on stage.
And I don't know, Forrest, do you want to add anything?
What was that like for you?
Yeah, well, one thing that's interesting about it, it's so fast that, especially for the rhythm instruments, me and Joe Smart is the name of the our guitarist, and for him and me in particular, it's a real workout for the right arm, you know, chopping and strumming. When we initially recorded that song for the first album that we did, Coming Home, it was one of the few, there were some where we did overdubs, like most of the songs actually had overdubs on them, but that one we wanted to just capture like live, kind of just get the vibe of it in the studio. It's tough to do that where you're kind of trying to, you know, lay a mandolin chop again over a guitar track that's already kind of taken place. Like, you just kind of want to get it. I think maybe we did it 4 times. It was like 3 or 4 in the studio. And by that point, you can't do it anymore. It's just like you've run out of steam. And the day before the Grammy performance, we had, you know, the production crew was great and we had soundcheck for it, but soundcheck went on literally for an hour. We played it more times on that stage rehearsing than we did in the studio. I think we did it 5 times all the way through. And at that pace, it was like, I mean, I went home and my arm had never hurt that much from playing before. I was actually worried I wouldn't be able to play the next day, like the day that we had the show, because I could like not bend it all the way. And it was like, that was so intense. But it's one of the funny things about that song. On the Grammys, it was probably the fastest we ever did it. But we never quite know how fast it's going to be until Joe plays the 3 notes on the guitar that kind of lead up to the main first chord. So he sets the tempo. So there's always this like kind of lingering tension in the air for me, because it's a workout and it's like, please, Joe, don't go, you know, too fast. And then like sometimes he'll just rip into it and then we have to keep up, like we can't slow down. And that one was particularly fast.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS 89.5 FM. That's Finger Lakes Public Radio.
And we're also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.